Welcome, welcome. Today we have a very insightful guest, Matthew Loftus. He's a family doctor who lives and works in Kenya. In this episode, we're focusing on his piece in Plough Quarterly on porn addiction and how it affects brain development and relationships. We hope you get as much out of our conversation as we did. So today we have Matthew Loftus, who, from what I've looked at your work, you're an MD, you're an author, so you've been published in a lot of places, First Things, Comment Magazine, there's a few others. Yeah, so I guess, why am I introducing you? I first want to hear, like, tell us about you, like, tell us about your work. I understand you work in Africa part-time, in Kenya and in the States, so just tell us about who you are.
Yeah, well, I'm so honored to be on today and glad to be joining you guys. I think what you're doing with the podcast is really important and touching on dimensions of health that aren't just, yeah, more people need to be thinking about and talking about and integrating into their lives. So thanks for having me on. So yes, I am a family doctor. I did all my training in Maryland, in Baltimore City, where we lived for a couple of years before we moved to Africa. And so we moved to Africa in 2015. We were initially in South Sudan, had to evacuate because of civil war. And then we came to Kenya. And here we work in a little town called Litane, on the western side of the Great Rift Valley. Beautiful tea growing country up here. And I teach family medicine to residents, interns, others. And really our goal is just equipping and empowering African physicians to care for their communities and to be transforming the health systems. Here in Kenya and in other countries, our residency program takes people from all over East Africa. So, yeah, I have I'm here with my family. We've lived here in Kenya since 2017, and my wife is a mother baby nurse, but mostly she's homeschooling our kids. So we have four kids, ages 10, 7, 5, and 6 months. And, yeah, we love living here, working here, and, getting to be a part of, just a really wonderful community of care.
Wow. So you've been there a long time then. I didn't even realize it's 5 years, right?
Yeah.
If I'm doing the math correctly. Mm-hmm. Wow. Very cool.
Yeah.
Do you guys come back and visit the States much, or are you mostly there all the time?
We're mostly here. We get back to the U.S. about once a year or once every other year.
And I imagine that's a with four kids. That's not an easy.
It's a lot to be going back and forth. So we don't, you know. Yeah, once a year or less.
Well, so let's just dive in. One of the reasons we wanted to have you on the show was because when Cassie and I were kicking around ideas for season two of the podcast, we really felt like an episode on porn was really warranted because, you know, we focus on sexual health and wellness and fertility health and wellness. And unfortunately, when it comes to sexual health and a lot of people's sexual experiences, especially in the United States, and maybe you can talk to whether or not this is the case in other parts of the world, porn is almost kind of like a foregone conclusion that it would be part of someone's sexual experience. And even you see people talk about how it can be like this healthy way of exploring one's sexuality, right? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't that there's something about that just doesn't sit right. That doesn't seem quite right for us here at Natural Womanhood. And so we came across this article that you wrote for Plough called Freedom from Porn Addiction. And it's such a great article because you take the issue of porn without, you know, there's no no shame, no finger pointing in this article at all. It's almost very pastoral in a sense, I think, the tack that you take. And I thought too, once I started looking more into your background as an MD, that it could be really interesting to have a discussion with you as someone with medical training, to discuss what exactly is a porn addiction. Is it proper to even use that word addiction? I mean, you must think it is because that's the title of the article. Mm-hmm. And so I think it would be really helpful just at the outset in defining some terms, like what do we mean when we say a porn addiction? Is it the same thing as, you know, an addiction to a drug or to alcohol? So I think let's just start there. Why call it a porn addiction?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a good place to start, because I think, you're absolutely right that unfortunately it is a bit of a foregone conclusion for many people, assuming that, it's just going to be, you know, boys will be boys or, you know, worse. And it certainly doesn't have to be like that. When we talk about porn addiction, really we just talk about addiction, you know, defining addiction behaviorally in terms of, well, is it something that, is it something that someone does compulsively? Is it something they feel like they can't stop doing? Is it something they feel like that's affecting their relationships? And so sadly that a lot of people who regularly look at pornography would use all of those things to describe their relationship with pornography, that they don't like that they do it. They feel like it's not healthy or good for them. They want to stop, that they feel like it's having negative effects on their life and their relationships. And certainly very often, you know, the partners of people who are using pornography feel like it's harming their relationship. And so, on that side, from kind of a behavioral standpoint, that's the way we would often describe addiction. And certainly the science that has, you know, studied addiction and, you know, now a variety of other behaviors finds that, you know, there's these cycles of behavior around pornography use or other addictive behaviors, and release of buildup and release of dopamine that provides people a certain amount of satisfaction in something that, you know, is meant to be, you know, sexual, sexual relationship, sexual release is meant to be a good, healthy part of a relationship. And yet when it's divorced from that context, it just provides ever decreasing reward for ever increasing stimulus with, you know, more and more what we call dysphoria, you know, so just feeling bad in and around, you know, pretty much in everything, all, you know, the rest of your life compared to that one moment of, release, getting high almost that, and then the rest of your life is kind of miserable, unless you're engaging in the behavior and seeking after it. So there's kind of those two senses there.
I really like the idea of like, let me rephrase my thought. I wrote a piece for Natural Womanhood recently on the female orgasm, and sort of all of the hormonal components of an orgasm, basically. And I like the idea of, you know, all these hormones are meant towards bonding, like meant towards like connecting with another human. And so when you use the term divorcing it from that, and I thought that was really an eloquent way to put it, because you are sort of like watering it down to like you're taking the connection piece out of it. you mentioned also negative effects. What are some of the negative effects that you see this happening in couples, you know, marriages? And
probably the most important one is just a decrease in sexual satisfaction in, you know, your relationship with your partner, you know, with, you know, obviously in many, majority of porn addicts are male. There are, women can get addicted to porn too. And sometimes that can be an area of extra shame for them. But, you know, very often it's men who are addicted to pornography. And because their mind is being reshaped by what the images that they expose themselves to, it decreases their ability to connect sexually with their wives. Sometimes even to the point of not being able to physically, get an erection or orgasm with a flesh and blood woman. And certainly there's plenty of other doctors who are reporting that they're seeing this problem more and more. Young people coming to them saying, young men coming to them saying that they're having difficulty getting an erection or reaching orgasm unless they are using pornography. They can't perform with a real woman, which is really tragic, the more that you think about it. So, that component of making real sex that much harder and more difficult is one. Many women report a feeling of being betrayed, betrayal trauma. It is kind of like you're being cheated on. Obviously, the images themselves are fake. And so they create a sense of body dysmorphia, you might say, So for a woman wondering, okay, what does my husband think? If this is what my husband likes to look at, how can I ever compare to, these, supermodels and whatnot. Certainly also I think it reshapes people's sexual desires and the way that they look at other people around them. I think men who are looking at pornography have a much harder time, treating women around them with respect because they're just more used to thinking of women as sexual objects for their enjoyment and, again, not real human beings. So those are just a few of the really harmful effects. Pornography is very frequently cited as a reason for divorce in divorce cases. And from my experience talking with, just being in groups with men who are recovering from pornography use, people just talk about how their lives were destroyed by their addiction, families broken up. Yeah.
And gosh, today, nowadays, it's like when you think about it, it's an exponential curve in terms of how people have been able to access it. It used to be like, get not that I know, I wasn't around then, but it used to be get the Playboy magazine from whatever, under lock, whatever.
That's the way older people, older addicts in these groups will talk about.
And now I was exposed just right through, here, And also the volume. Not just the accessibility, but the volume. You would literally never exhaust yourself of things. And so I can imagine it's inviting an alcoholic to a bar, where the well never runs dry. And I think as a parent, that's one of the forefront things. I mean, my children aren't, my oldest is 7, but I think about like, oh, as this progresses, like as they get older, what can I do to, you know, how can I responsibly educate them on this? So do you have any thoughts?
Yeah,
right. Absolutely. Because yeah, I mean, one thing that you said, Matthew, is, you know, the remodeling of the brain that happens. And we already know that teen brains are so malleable. Right. Mm-hmm. They're there for the modeling for anyone or anything that wants to do it. Right. And that is really pretty terrifying, especially because as you described, it goes from the remodeling of the brain to the physiological effects just follow very naturally from it. And so we could be, if we're not vigilant as parents, with not just our teen boys, but our teen girls. And, you know, there have been some horrifying statistics cited that like most kids are have seen their first, you know, pornographic image by like age like 8 or 9 now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a really pressing issue because it does have those effects on the brain. And especially when we're talking about teens and even kids younger than teens and how malleable their brains are, how easily influenced they are. Mm-hmm. Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also, you know, I mean, not to sort of dwell on the horrors, but I mean, it's also getting more and more extreme. And, you know, women are reporting more and more that there are sexual acts that are frequently displayed in pornography that they feel pressured into doing. They also, you know, young girls also very frequently feel pressured into sending naked pictures of themselves. As you know, part of a relationship, and because otherwise, they say, well, you know, my boyfriend will look at porn if I don't do this, and so just a lot of, just a lot of compounding tragedies there,
and so many parallels to drug use, right? Because that's mm-hmm. almost kind of some of the rhetoric that you hear around, like, what do they call them? Like safe shoot up sites, like safe observation sites, mm-hmm. where we know these, drug addicts are going to do this anyway, and needle exchange programs and that sort of thing. So let's at least, you know, have them do it in a place where they're observed, have them do it with clean needles. That's almost kind of the same thing, what you're talking about to me, it sounds like with porn. Like I know my boyfriend is going to use it anyway. So in order to have myself feel a little bit better about it, I'll just make sure he has images of me
that
he can be using.
Yeah.
Just so many parallels to drug use. And I don't understand how folks can't then make that leap that we know, you know, what you were talking about, the neurological effects on the brain. That needing that bigger high, basically, mm-hmm. or needing that bigger hit to get the high each time. How we can't be seeing that same thing happening with porn and saying like, wow, we don't want our kids using drugs, we don't want our teens using drugs, so we put safeguards in place. But there doesn't seem to be that same urgency around.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Porn, at least.
Yeah, just thinking for myself, you know, when I was in high school, I just was under the assumption that the boys will be boys mentality. Like, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, mm-hmm. and to a large degree, I do think young men will come across that. Like, there's not, like, you know, but it doesn't have to become an addiction. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be something that becomes just commonplace in their life. But as a young girl, mm-hmm. as a young woman, I felt like I didn't have a right to say I wasn't comfortable with it because I felt like it was something that men just needed, or it was just part of like their own sexual health and wellness because it was kind of marketed as that in the media. What do you have any practical tips on where if a couple is dealing with one of the people in the couple having an addiction, like where are some resources mm-hmm. that people can go?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say kind of the first thing that I would say to any couple is to get help from other people. Because especially if one person feels like they're addicted, it can be it's very, very difficult to handle that by yourself or just within your relationship. I think even, especially again, because of the relational dynamics and the betrayal trauma and all of that, the feeling that, you know, you're being cheated, you know, very often, people rightly feel like if their spouse is using pornography, then they're cheating on them. And so that makes it very, very hard to do it just by yourself or as a couple. And if you're, virtually by definition, if you are addicted to anything, you can't quit by yourself. I mean, one of the criteria we use to say you're addicted to something is you already tried to quit by yourself. And it didn't work over and over. And, very many people, by the time that they ask for help, they've already tried many, many times over months or years. And so kind of the first piece of advice is to reach out to help, to reach out to others. There are a lot of, groups, 12-step groups, more or less, that are available to help people to quit. So Sex Addicts Anonymous, Sexaholics Anonymous, are two, more, secular ones. There's a Christian, group called Samson Society, that exists primarily for men just to connect with one another and deal with whatever they have going on in their life. But, a lot of people join it, in their journey, to quit pornography. So reaching out for help, joining a group, I think exploring, the reasons why, someone's engaging in addictive behavior. Not everyone has to have a great, there's not always this deep, compelling trauma or what have you that drives people, but very frequently people develop addictive behaviors. They get addicted to something because they are self-medicating some kind of internal emotional pain or difficulty. And so it's very helpful to explore that, maybe with a professional or maybe with with good friends. Again, it's a lot of it really is about developing healthy relationships with others that help you to overcome that. And being with people that encourage you to do better, and to live a life free of pornography. For people who feel like they're really, they're really, really trapped, or especially if they kind of want to, get into recovery faster. There are a variety of rehabilitation program, like short intensives, some shorter, some longer, like I did a 3-day program at a place called Bethesda Workshops in Nashville, which was really, really great. But certainly not necessary, but very, very helpful for getting in a lot of recovery work very quickly and figuring out a plan to go forward. So that's what I would tell somebody who themselves is addicted. And then for the spouse, I would say, it's a really hard, painful thing to walk through. That person, is also, also needs support. They also need friends. They also need other people they can talk to. It's helpful to connect with other people who, have walked through this with their spouse. because, you know, one of the hard things, pornography addiction is so common. But it's always, it's not something people talk about. It's not as public. If you have recovered, people might, you might not be very open about it. Or certainly if your spouse has recovered,
right.
Other people may not know that. And so really, yeah. Connecting with other people, ensuring that your spouse is actually working at a program and working to get better. Because it is easy to say, yes, I'm doing something about it and not really doing anything to get, So if someone is not continuously trying to improve and making changes, that's certainly a red flag. Just like drug addiction, there are people who go to rehab, who go to groups, and they can't quit it. And, that might not be something that you can continue to live with, right. Sadly. And sometimes that is a consequence. But that's kind of what I would say, both to the person who is addicted and the spouse who is trying to help and support the person.
So if you're a spouse or a parent and you suspect that your husband, your teenage son might be struggling with this, what would some of the warning signs be of that from the outside? Are there any kind of telltale warning signs?
Definitely. There are some warning signs. I think probably the most important is just long periods of time unaccounted for. Most people who use pornography tend to, the more that someone's addicted to it, the more time that they spend on it. Searching for more and more different things and whatnot. Certainly someone who is struggling to connect, obviously there's lots of reasons why someone might be distant and struggling to connect in a relationship. A spouse who really struggles to connect sexually, would be a warning sign. Long periods of time where you have no idea what they're doing and it doesn't seem like they're doing anything. And they have any access to any kind of device, during that period of time. Is a warning sign. Someone who seems to who has very little sense of boundaries around sexuality, I think is just one of those signs that someone's brain has been reshaped by porn. Just that they don't have any sense of propriety around sex. Yeah, those would be the biggest things that I'd be concerned about.
And then, so if you are suspicious, what then are you to do? Are you to approach that person directly, whether it is your spouse, whether it's a child, and how do you do it in a way that doesn't come off as very accusatory? Because obviously, you might be coming from a place of deep hurt if it is your spouse.
Yeah.
How do you even begin to broach that? And are you supposed to broach it with the person directly?
Yeah. I think it is good to broach it directly. And I think that it is good to, be straightforward and clear and to ask a question that is direct and not euphemistic. Because I think that, it's very hard to admit that you're addicted, and it's very hard to admit that to somebody that you love. It's very hard to admit that to somebody, where admitting that might have consequences. You know, obviously, if it's a spouse, then, you know, there's going to be consequences for your relationship for that truth to come out, as painful and necessary as that is. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wants to admit that, to pull that rusty nail out of the flesh wound, you know, and of it, mm-hmm. you know, same as, you know, not the same dynamic if it's a parent and a child, but obviously if you're a parent, then, you know, I think you have a certain responsibility to make whatever changes are necessary in the household to make it harder for someone, for your kid to be using pornography. So, you know, I don't think you should lead with that question. I think, you know, it should be part of a context of a conversation of, you know, how are you doing emotionally, spiritually? You know, do you feel, you know, and I would be specific about the things that you notice. You know, you seem disconnected, you seem down, you seem like you're in another world. I don't know what you're doing, you know, what for those hours and hours at a time, you know, seems mm-hmm. like you're, you know, you never come to bed, you know, you don't come to bed on time. You know, I find whatever it is, whatever specific behavior that you can point to. And then I would just, you know, ask point blank, are you looking at pornography? And, you know, obviously people who are in the grip of addiction lie. Deception is another one of those hallmarks of addictive behavior.
Right.
You know, and if someone chooses to lie, like, that's on them. Usually someone gets caught if you have gotten to the point that you're asking someone directly and you think they lied to you, then, you know,
you're probably going to catch them.
You'll probably catch them. Yeah. Yeah. People are good at covering their tracks, but they're not that good. You know, if they tell the truth, then I think the first thing to say is, thank you for telling me the truth. And I love you, and I want to help you get out of this, because, you know, it's hurting you and it's hurting me. And then kind of go from there. Obviously there's lots of, you know, once that truth comes out, then there are a lot of other things that, I think you would want to say that need to be said, that you need to say to that person. But in that moment, I think you just have to say, I'm glad that you told me the truth. I'm glad that we're, you know, let's fix this together.
Yeah.
Let's help you.
I'm thinking too, on the parent child end. I was listening to a podcast a while ago, and I don't even remember the name. I don't even remember what it was, but they were talking about like how to talk to your kids about porn basically before they see it. Mm-hmm. In a very simplistic kind of manner. And it starts as young as, like, you know, my daughter's 7. Again, I'm not giving explicit details, but I'm saying, you know, parts about, you know, your swimsuit parts, like, if you know, we don't show pictures of that to other people. We wouldn't, you know, so other people that do that. Mm-hmm. And which is sort of wild as a parent to think about having those conversations. But do you have any thoughts on, like, how we can have those conversations with our kids through the various stages that they go through, you know, because bringing it up one time at 7 might not be enough. Maybe you have to bring it up again at 10 or 12. Oh,
yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you guys have done a podcast on this already. If not, you probably should, just about talking to your kids about sex in general.
That's a good idea. Actually. Yeah. Thanks for that.
We should. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I mean, there are, and you know, there's some great resources out there. Our family has kind of these staged books, right? So there's, you know, there's one that you start with when your kids are 3 to 5 years old and they're asking about, you know, the different parts. And, you know, I mean, I remember at the dinner table, there was a very interesting conversation between two of my kids, one of whom was older than the other. And, you know, the older one was explaining, well, there's a part from the mommy and there's a part from the daddy, and they come together to make the baby. Mm-hmm. And the younger child was like, but how do the two parts come together? So, and I, oh, you know, great. I remember from my, you know, I was homeschooled and, you know, we did a human body unit. And, you know, one day my dad came home and there was a picture of, you know, each me and my siblings had drawn a picture of the heart and lungs. It was on next to the kitchen table. And then one day he came home and there was a picture of two male genitalia and one female genitalia for my me, my brother and my sister. And, you know, so it's just part of what we talked about, you know. So, you know, you start young, you know, and you start, there's a great book called Good Pictures, Bad Pictures that actually, again, it has two versions, one for younger kids, one for older kids. You know, and, you know, for our kids, we're, you know, talking about things more in generalities. And I think as they get older, you know, you have to be, unfortunately, you have to be more and more specific, right. About these kinds of things, and about kind of the pressures that they face. You know, and I think, again, the analogy to drugs is appropriate, you know, because you just have to sort of say, well, you know, you're gonna, the temptation is going to be there. Right. You're going to be interested to try it.
I think the inevitability is, it's probably going to happen. Like at some point.
Yeah. You have to make your peace with that. Right. You just have to come at it from that mindset that they did with the DARE programs. When we were all in like elementary, middle school around drugs, you know, like they did take that mindset and smoking too. Like you are going to be exposed to this and here's how we're going to head it off. Yeah. And we need to be doing that with
porn. And I think I would argue that just say no isn't like enough, because then we need to give people, okay, well then what to say yes to. And I also think it's a really fine line with the shame piece, because as a female, it's like, well, how do you come at this in a way that isn't also saying, you know, oh, but you're a terrible person. Your body is, you know, like, I don't know. It's just very nuanced, I feel, especially having both a son and a daughter and thinking about, okay, well, how do I broach these subjects while acknowledging that the feelings and the emotions there are real, because, oh my gosh, I mean, puberty is so intense. Like the hormones are so crazy.
Yeah.
So those sort of that curiosity is normal. But it's the actions that matter, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think kind of what going off of that, Cassie. Yeah, I think there is an importance to acknowledge, and you said this too, Matthew, acknowledge that there will be that temptation, that there will be that curiosity, right? And I think that that is almost freeing in a way to our kids, like, because I can imagine, you know, like if you are an 8-year-old boy and you were exposed to that and never having had any kind of conversation surrounding sexuality or pornography, even tangentially at that age, you know, having even that feeling alone of like, why am I curious about this? Why is that something I want to see again? Could be enough of an internalized shame to make you want to keep it on the down low and to hide it. When you do, you know, potentially go seeking it out again. So I do think what you guys have said about at the very outset with our kids in age appropriate ways, saying, you know, you might come across something that makes you feel a certain way. And that's not that that's okay, but that's how a lot of people do feel when they see these images. And it is what your behavior is after the fact that is going to define, you know, your approach.
Yeah, and it's part of a wider conversation about sex and sexuality and, you know, what it is, you know, the other sexual feelings or, you know, what have you that you're having as you develop, as you grow. Fortunately, there are a lot more, you know, there's a lot of sophisticated tools out there that parents can use to monitor what is being observed, what's being accessed on devices in their home. Obviously, nothing is foolproof. And you can't control what your kid will or won't use outside of the house. Obviously. But that can be, you know, that can be an opportunity for conversations about it as well. You know, and again, part of the ongoing, you know, what is, you know, obviously something you guys are very interested in here on this podcast is, you know, what is sex for? And whatnot. What are our bodies about? Understanding and appreciating every aspect of ourselves.
And I think fertility awareness education, it's like such a natural
partnership,
I'm thinking part of what fertility awareness education does, especially for teenagers but also anyone, is it gives them like, oh, that's what that's about, that's what those hormones are doing, that's what I was going to bring this up earlier, but in the well, I did, but the orgasm piece I mentioned, talking about how oxytocin is like one of the main drivers of an orgasm, like that feel good, ooey gooey, like connection feeling, and that's
the bonding hormone we have
during birth, and it's the same hormone we have every time we have a letdown when we lactate to breastfeed. That's not a mistake. Like that's not like a coincidence. No.
Just the connection to connecting it back to kind of the telos, right? The what all of this is for that your body is doing. And if you're a teen and you're navigating all of this on your own outside of any kind of context, like you're talking about, I think the feeling is, oh gosh, why is this happening to me? You know, I kind of like it, but I don't. I feel shame about it, you know, and without that broader context to put your sexuality, contextualize it in the framework of the wholeness of your person.
Exactly.
That's when we start running into problems.
And I think
problems,
too,
right?
And you can speak maybe to what culturally it's like in Africa. I mean, I've never been, so I don't have any firsthand experience, but I've always said that children and kids and teens and, you know, even toddlers need to be around the full spectrum of reproductive health. So it's like teenage boys should see babies breastfeeding. Teenage boys should, they don't need to see a birth necessarily, but they should be aware of like what.
I did. I was better for it. I mean, I'm the oldest of 15 kids. So,
wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Like I think we've, again, using that word divorce, we've divorced sexuality from the physical realities of what it is and what it leads to. And I feel like if men and girls and boys, if they saw that, I certainly didn't, right? Like I didn't see much birth. I didn't see much postpartum. Like that wasn't, I mean, that's, I work in that field now. So of course I'm like bringing it to that. But I think that's part of it. Like, I don't think there's the connection for teenagers that, it's just a much bigger picture. You know, the pleasure.
So context is everything, right? Fertility awareness puts sex and sexuality into the context of your whole life, you know, your whole fertility life, and the wholeness of your person. Whereas pornography really decontextualizes sex, right? Like there is no context around it except just that high, that feeling that you get with the release, right? So yeah, I think there's something there that I'm going to be chewing on for sure. Long after we hang up, because I do think, inculcating that context in our kids starting from a young age really is probably our greatest weapon as parents for protecting our kids from some of this stuff. And of course, it won't be foolproof, right? But also that also lays the groundwork for if someone falls for their healing later on too.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
Do you have anything, Matthew, you want to add, parting words, thoughts?
Just sort of one last kind of thought to what you were saying, you know, if you hopefully this isn't too weird or crude, but I think that if you, you know, if your experience of different, you know, if you have seen different parts of the human body being used for all the things that they are used for, you know, breastfeeding, childbirth, I think that helps you to have a much better context for understanding what the body is for. And I think that in some ways does help you, you know, that I think it can help you to break one of the lies of pornography, which is that, you know, those part, you know, other people's bodies exist for my pleasure. You know, breasts are ornamental playthings and not, you know, sources of nutrition, for example.
That's great. I really like that. Thank you, Matthew. I will let you go because it looks like it's probably late there in Kenya.
It is. And yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the show with us. We really enjoyed having you. We'll maybe have that follow-up episode that I think is needed about how to start talking to your kids about sex. Well, I think that's a great place to end. I think we covered a lot of ground. I'm really happy with where we went in this episode. And I have stuff to chew on. I hope you guys have stuff to chew on. And I hope our listeners have stuff to chew on.
Thanks for listening. Next time, we're interviewing Dr. Sarah Denny, an ethics professor at Loyola University in New Orleans. She holds a PhD in bioethics and does a lot of work with teens around hormonal health and sex education. Stay tuned for our conversation.